It's time for Twink This Week in Google. Oh, I'm excited about this show. Jeff Jarvis is here. He's at MIT's Media Lab. Kevin Marks is visiting us from somewhere in North England. And all the way from the United States Digital Service, Acting Administrator Matt Cutts. We're going to discuss the latest news from Google, Facebook, and the U.S. government. It's all next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig, episode 416, recorded Wednesday, August 2nd, 2017. Mr. Nutter Butter has a message for you. This Week in Google is brought to you by Cloudflare. More than 6 million websites, apps, APIs, and SaaS companies use Cloudflare's services to weather whatever the internet throws at them. For a free online chat session with one of Cloudflare's brilliant support engineers, visit cloudflare.com/twit. It's time for Twink This Week in Google, the show where we cover the latest news from Google and the Googleverse. And boy, do we have a panel today. Stacey Higginbotham still has the week off. I think maybe Jeff Jarvis, we chased her away. Jeff Jarvis is here, but he's not as normal.
Hey.
He's not as.
Hey.
Okay, you, not. I mean, me, not you. It was me.
Hey.
Jeff is at MIT's Media Lab. What are you doing there?
Mm-hmm. I'm seeing Deb Roy of MIT on Twitter tomorrow for a News Integrity Initiative business. And so I came in early so I could do the show. So I scheduled the flight. You're going to hear the story now. I scheduled the flight so I could land at 1 o'clock, nice and easy, right? Get over here, check in the hotel, Perfect. Get over here, do the show. So I didn't take the train. Nope. I did everything.
Yep.
Thunderstorms in Newark. Then we finally get up in the air. Thunderstorms over Boston. I buy the Wi-Fi for once it works so I can email Karsten and say, I don't know if I'm going to make it or not. I don't know if I'm going to make it or not. Then I get a cabbie who had no idea where he was going, so I'm dashing down the street. But I'm here. We started 45 minutes late.
Bravo, Jeff Jarvis.
Half of which is my fault. But.
I'm glad you're here because you are going to help me welcome. Well, first let me introduce Kevin Marks before I welcome our special guest. Kevin Marks is here.
No offense, Kevin, you're not the special guest.
He's pretty special.
I'm the less special guest.
He's the less special. But I think he'd agree too. From IndieWeb.org. It's great to see you, Kevin, as always.
It's great to see you guys too.
Half the time we do this show, Stacey in particular would say, well, I wonder what Kevin Marks would say about that. So
I miss Stacey as well. I'm sad she's not here.
But yeah.
I'm sure we'll find something to talk about anyway.
We will find a few things to talk about because joining us for the first time in more than a year.
Hip, hip, hooray.
Mr. Matt Cutts of the U.S. Digital Service.
Hello. Good to see everybody. How are you?
Matt has been a long time friend of the show. I'm proud to say originally as the spam fighter at Google, one of the early employees at Google. And he went on leave last year? He went on leave, mm-hmm. Seems like about a year ago.
Feels like about 5 years ago. But
yeah. To go to work for the government and at the U.S. Digital Service, which is a really neat part of the government. And for a while you were at the Pentagon doing secret stuff. It's all about improving the technology in government, including web design and so forth. You may remember when healthcare.gov had its troubles, that Silicon Valley jumped in to help revamp it, make it work, and the USDS was born. And let me ask you, Matt, you're still the interim administrator there, yes?
That's right. Yes, I am the acting administrator of the U.S. Digital Service, and I just wanted to let people know that the U.S. Digital Service is still here, we're still hiring, and we're working on important problems that make things better for the American people.
Well, bravo. Yeah, your predecessor had to leave because she was a political appointee.
That's right.
But you're not a political appointee, apparently.
thus the acting in the acting administrator.
and we'll see if the administration gets around to appointing somebody to run the place. But I think it is, and I'm very gratified to hear, because you kind of wonder, is it getting funded? Is anything happening? But it sounds like you are.
We are, and it's really great because the people who needed help before the election still need help, and so the mission of the U.S. Digital Service is really important, and I'm glad that there's a fantastic group of geeks and designers and, you know, software engineers, a whole bunch of people who are willing to make sure that the U.S. Digital Service is, like, trying to help build important services and fix things that break.
What are some examples these days, Matt, what you guys are working on?
So one of my favorite ones is vets.gov, which is a place where people can discover, apply for, manage, and track their benefits. So if you are a veteran or know someone who is a veteran, if you've ever dealt with, the GI Bill comparison tools or trying to sign up for health benefits, this is basically a one-stop shop that's intended to make it really easy for people to find and apply for different benefits.
And I just want to point out, did you see how fast that site loaded? Let me do it again. Watch this. This is nohealthcare.gov. This thing loads faster than any website I've ever been on. And I imagine that is with a little help from the USDS.
We power a lot of that site. Yes, yeah. It's a fantastic service.
Nice. That's really, really good job. I'm just thrilled to have you back on. Now, are there limits? Tell me ahead of time of things we can ask you.
Well, if something gets too close to, you know, something legal or something too crazy, I might recuse myself.
You're always allowed to do that. But really, what's that Larry Page like, really? No, I'm just kidding.
He's a great guy.
Now you can tell us.
Actually, we could talk a little bit about Alphabet because their quarterly results came out. The stock went down, but I have no idea why, because Alphabet's numbers were excellent. Well, I guess what people are saying is it's more about the guidance Alphabet gave about the future and the fact that net revenue growth has gone down a little bit, but it's not like they're not doing really, really well. Net revenue for the ad business was up 16% during the second quarter, so it was up 20% last year. So that's the growth is still there, just slowing. But some analysts call that a meaningful deceleration. Net income profit, in other words, was so big that even after subtracting $2.7 billion for the EU fine, Alphabet still made $3.5 billion. So that's down, but that's because of the fine. If you add the two together, they made $6.2 billion.
And they aren't necessarily paying the fine. That's just holding it in advance.
Right. They have almost $95 billion in cash. Headcount went up almost 10,000 people. That's significant. Wow, this is maybe one issue, which is cost per click down 26%. Paid clicks, though, made up for it because they sold more ads, even though the value of each ad was down 26%. They sold 61% more ads. Paid clicks were up 61%. Revenues for other bets, that's Waymo, that's Nest, that's the life sciences, Verily, and so forth, $248 million, but they lost quarters of $1 billion on other bets. But that's what you kind of expect. Other bets means that, you know, stuff we're going to R&D, basically.
The future.
And Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, has been added to the board. It's 13th member.
Oh.
So.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Sure does. Sundar's rise has been somewhat meteoric, though, I have to say. I mean, I met him when he was head of Chrome OS. And that wasn't so very long ago.
I'd argued with him.
Now, let's not bring that up. I was wrong, and I admit it. This is back when it was that black Chromebook, remember, that everybody got?
CR48,
the preliminary. And I said, why would anybody want this? It's just a browser. Boy, was I wrong.
What kind of computer are you
right
using
at the time?
Now?
At the time, it was early. Yeah, Matt, do you get a government-issued PC? Oh, I can only imagine.
I do. It's a lot like the CR48, frankly.
Yeah, I bet it is. Yeah. But you get to have your own system, I'm sure.
Yeah, but it was interesting because I think it was at a holiday party. I think I got to see you.
I was there. You're exactly right. We
give Sundar a hard time. And you were right at the time. Like, Chrome OS couldn't do that much, and there were a lot of apps that people were using, so...
But he saw the long-term vision, and it really, I mean, there's no doubt that this is a huge success. Chrome OS as it's matured, but also has been embraced by education. I use it. I've purchased since then 5 or 6 Chromebooks. So I love it.
I just got my daughter a new Samsung Pro. I mean,
Plus.
Plus.
I gave my daughter a Plus, too, for school, for college.
She loves it.
Yep.
She loves it.
Yeah. She had that. I had given her my old Pixel, and I said, you know, maybe you'll like the Plus better because it's a lot lighter, and she does. It's just, you know, so there you go. It's also a lot less expensive. Now, this is a good time, perhaps, to bring up Project Eve. What do you know about Project Eve, Matt?
I know nothing.
Nothing. Nothing. So this is the rumored Chrome, but we talked a little bit about this last week, I think. Didn't we, Jeff?
Yeah, we did a bit. Yeah.
So there's nothing more to say about that. It's just that I feel like we're getting closer and closer. There's got to be an announcement.
I hope so.
Yeah. Because we want a successor to the Chromebook Pixel, which we loved.
Yeah.
All right. I guess I don't need to bring up Project Eve. I already brung it up.
Well, I mean, there is the weird thing that the Chromebook Pixel is still actually a quite usable machine, which is...
Absolutely.
Yes.
It was over-designed.
3.5 years ago. Well, there's two things going on there. One is that it was over-designed. The other is we've gone into the flat part of Moore's Law and things haven't been growing exponentially.
That's really true, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, your 5-year-old computer is probably just as fast as it was. The biggest change, in the last 5 years...
Moore's Law doesn't affect us... Moore's Law doesn't affect us at the PC level as much anymore, but doesn't it affect other areas, AI and such?
IoT?
Well, AI has gone massively parallel, so they're sort of working around it by throwing more CPUs at it, and because their projects are massively parallelizable, and GPUs have done the same thing. IoT cares more about power consumption than it does about CPU processing normally. So they're the other end of Moore's. There's another law that I forgot the name of, which is the amount of power you do, the same amount of computation does keep going down, and that's basically what the chipsets have been doing for the last few years as well, because they've been focusing on mobile. So they haven't been saying, oh, we need to keep growing execution speed. They've been saying we need to reduce power consumption further. Can we halve the voltage again? So that's been a big focus in chipsets over the last 5 years or so.
And, of course, PCs have sped up for other reasons. You know, more RAM, cheaper RAM, faster hard drives, SSDs have made a massive difference in the speeds.
Mm-hmm. That's mostly sort of replacing spinning metal with silicon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Again, very parallel silicon. Yeah. The point is we've gone from everything being a CPU bottleneck to having much more things in parallel, and that has made a difference. But it has made a difference to how we have to think about coding as well.
So the ad blocker is in. I frankly didn't believe this, but Google's ad blocker is now live in Canary and dev builds of Google Chrome, a native ad blocker in the browser.
I haven't played with it yet. Have any of you?
No, I'm not using Canary or even dev.
I'm not even on dev either. I should have a look.
Yeah. wait, now is dev... Canary is gamma, and then there's beta. Is dev even more early stage than Canary, or is it in the middle?
It's in the middle.
It's the beta version. Okay.
Yeah, there's like a train. The Canary is the earliest warning train, and then dev is, okay, we've got the bugs out that will probably destroy you. You should test this if you're building bleeding edge stuff. And then there's one more, and then there's release, right? And there's four.
It's four total. Okay.
Four? Canary, four? Dev, beta, and release.
That's right.
That's right, yeah.
So if it's in dev, it means it's fairly close. I don't know if they've said what version of Chrome it will be. And I think are we in 60 now? Or we're in 59?
No, it's not a complete ad blocker, right? Isn't it an ad blocker for certain kinds of ads?
They say intrusive.
For bad ads.
Intrusive ads.
Yeah, no, it's a...
I'm willing to bet none of the Google ads are intrusive. I'm just thinking.
I don't know. I mean, Matt has done this before where he's blocked Google ads, so I would believe that they would...
Now I know why you're working for the government.
Well, I have blocked when people would buy links that pass PageRank, right. But that's different. That's a violation of Google's guidelines. Right. But it does make sense to me that there are certain classes of ads that are really beyond the pale. And so if somebody's a good citizen, you know, then absolutely, I don't block those ads myself, you know. Right. But if somebody's doing something really intrusive or really deceptive, then I can see, you know, in the same way that Google uses safe browsing to protect users, it might do something similar to protect them against, you know, nasty ads in those ways.
Ooh, I just got 60. So we are now at 60. Yeah, that makes a lot. Yes. I think it's you know what? It's just like, I mean, this is, I mean, the phrase that comes to mind is hell froze is freezing over. You just don't expect a company that makes its money from advertising to put an ad blocker in. But I think a lot of what Google's done in the last couple of years, AMP is another example, is to shore up the business against people who are just blocking all ads.
Quality. It's yeah, and it's also a quality question.
It got
so
bad.
Probably 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I wrote a post about 2 years ago suggesting the publishers should create their own ad blocker. And really what all you're doing is you're setting the standard.
Right.
And you're saying this is the standard, and we will help you get rid of all the junk below, and we'll warrant that we're above that line.
Right.
So have the publishers joined this coalition for better ads that Google has sort of delegated this to?
Some did, yes. I think so.
Here it is. It's betterads.org. And maybe it'll say who. Yeah, members. Let's see who's members. Oh, a lot of them. A lot of ad blockers. Procter and Gamble.
News Corp. Okay.
News Corp. Procter and Gamble.
P&G made a fair bit of noise about getting rid of lots of useless ads last month, didn't they?
Right,
they said
they dumped a bunch of ads. Yeah,
$100 million worth of ads of
were they mostly
digital
Facebook
ads?
Or it was just digital across the board.
They were a little opaque about exactly what it was, but they said we cut this, which $100 million, it's, you know, it's a reasonable fraction of their budget, but it's not that much of their budget because they're P&G. But their point was, these are the ones that weren't doing anything for us. We wanted to get rid of them. And I think it was the more, supposedly better targeted ones. They're big brand advertisers. It's very hard to sort of do social targeting on bleach and things, but it's
is it really?
I'm just thinking who would be a targeted ad for bleach. Serial killer is near.
Yeah, there you go. Anybody running an email server, you know, those kinds of people. Interactive Advertising Bureau is a member. Unilever is a member. Thomson Reuters, Washington Post. I don't see the New York Times on here. I do see Facebook on here.
Yeah, no. So it's Google and Facebook, who are obviously, they are all the growth in the ads industry, and they want to maintain that. So part of this is them saying, there's a lot of ad tech out there that's shady. You should stick with us, well-known sort of big brands, and we'll make a coalition with you know, the rest of you. Then there's, you know, and there's some reason to that.
I don't see Outbrain or Taboola in here either. I'd be interested.
Well, let me tell you about that. So so as I've mentioned before on the show, at the News Integrity Initiative, and we're doing at CUNY, we partnered with Storyful and Moat, and we're now collecting kind of the worst of the lowest hanging rotten fruit of web stuff. And boy, if you look at these URLs,
what are the worst ads? Tell me one that's really.
These aren't ads. These are sites. Are sites. I'm getting there in a second. So these are sites that have the real made up fake news junk.
Oh, okay.
And I wish I had it in front of me now to give you examples.
Oh, I can find.
But what we're seeing, we're also checking those pages and how they work with the recirculation engine. So it's not just Taboola and Outbrain. Don't forget that Newsmax has one. And Rev Content is another one. And so they are throwing, those organizations are throwing both traffic and revenue at the fake news sites. So part of what we're going to try to do there is clean that up. This is a conversation I want to buy Matt lunch. Well, I guess I'm probably not allowed to. I want to share a coffee with Matt and get some of his insight about this, about how you attack this moving beast. But what we're seeing in the fake news stuff is that there's a lot more money going to them than I ever would have imagined. From ad networks and such, and so what you're seeing is it's not just about a junky ad on a page. It's also about fake news content being promoted, and it's also about legitimate ads showing up on junky content.
Right. So here's an example. This is kind of one of the most famous. abcnews.com.co which is actually does double duty because ABC could be the Australian broadcasting company or the American broadcasting company. I've got an ad blocker on. Let me just refresh this minus the ad blocker, get the ads to pop up here. And, oh, here's five must-see places to see in Amsterdam and Prague and make a difference, donate, and help the homeless. And interesting facts you must know about beard growth. Feel free to ride your motorcycle in the middle of the road from now on. Actually, this isn't as fake as it used to be. This is pretty
well,
legit.
Well, that's what they do. They put in 80% okay looking, and then to get the 20%
right, right. And they actually don't have as many ads as I expected, but maybe that's because Google and others are making it harder for them to buy ads. I don't see any Google ads on here.
Maybe that's progress.
Yeah. Well, that's part of it, isn't it? Is to under. Wow. If you want to have some fun, go to the bottom of this page. I'm not going to show it on the air. And read this fine print disclaimer at the bottom. Because it starts normal and it gets weird. Yes, it just gets weird. Wow. I highly encourage it for a little extra credit. So that's one thing, Matt, right? I mean, I know you're no longer, you know, at Google, but I think that's one thing. Or are you? Are you technically not at Google, or are you?
I am no longer with Google. So okay. I resigned December 31st, 2016. So, but it's Google has a very clear pattern over years and years and years of saying, hey, you know, try to make sure that you can allow lots of great, you know, innovation on the web, free speech, fantastic stuff. But then when people start to abuse, you know, whether it's spam or whether it's, you know, malicious content or intrusive ads or whatever, you know, okay, what is a reasonable guideline or path to sort of push people towards better behavior? And some people might resent that, but for example, with Chrome, they're moving more towards making the web encrypted. And so over time, over the course of a year or two, they're making it so that HTTP stuff will show more warnings. And so I think the most recent was if you are entering a form and it's an HTTP, not an HTTPS form, right, then they'll show you a warning. Right. So they're just gradually trying to push the web towards being, you know, a good, well-lit place where high quality information happens. And that includes the whole ecosystem, the quality of the information, which you see in the search results and the algorithms they have there, but also how that gets monetized, because you want to be able to support publishers, but you don't want to support bad behavior.
Actually, it strikes me, I realize we have not talked to you since this whole fake news thing surfaced.
Yeah. Yep.
And I'm sure you've been watching this with interest, because on the one hand, you stated it perfectly, which is you want to encourage innovation and free speech on the internet, but you also want to make sure that I don't know, how do you define fake news how do you define fake news personally, but how do you algorithmically define fake news? How can you determine what's fake, and how do you then, you know, weed it out?
Well, there's lots of ways where you could try to think about the algorithms, and you could try to, you know, check the quality of the content, the quality of the channel or the publisher, you know, are these facts, you know, corroborated in different places that are also reputable or believable. But I think what's more interesting has been the trend towards saying, okay, what can we do, you know, to make sure that things are vouched and that the user interface supports things? So I remember when the very first thing happened, it was because some egregiously misleading or false news got into, you know, sort of one box, which was originally news sources only, and things have to be vetted to get into the Google News corpus. And so my initial take, and I was, you know, still had access to Google email, so I was, you know, throwing my opinion around, was, look, this should only be the new Google News corpus, not just things that look kind of interesting or hot topics. And I think, I don't know, maybe some stronger action a little earlier there could have nipped some of that in the bud. I will say, like, in the same way that the ABC News example seems a little better, I just noticed last week, like, you haven't really heard about fake or malicious or egregiously bad news in Google search results for a while. And normally you only notice when things bad happen. And I noticed nothing bad had happened for a little while. And so,
congratulations.
You know, which is, you know, normally you only notice when people complain. And so right. I know that the people at Google are taking it very seriously and are trying to, you know, make it better.
So Matt, did you see the Ben Gomes post that he put up about 2 months ago about changes in structure? I saw that as a – I think they were trying to soft pedal it, but I think that the fact that Ben said that they were going to account for the reliability, quality, and authority of sources was a sea change in how Google had to operate. What do you think?
I don't consider it a sea change so much as a doubling down. The fact that it was Ben Gomes saying it, you know, carries a lot of weight because
he's
you know,
VP
Ben
of engineering.
Exactly. You know, if you're talking about search ranking, you really will have a hard time finding someone more reputable than that. And it also fit the timeline of like November, December when people start talking about it. Normally it takes Google at least 3 or 4 months if they're going to do a systemic change or an algorithmic change. You know, like if something launches and then something launches the next day, that's usually coincidence. So the fact that you saw that happen a few months later, in my mind from the outside, is like, okay, Google knew it was a problem. They did a full review. They said, okay, what are the issues and what can we solve, you know, algorithmically or reasonably to take care of the most egregious, most misleading, most false kind of things? And I'm sure they'll keep iterating. But I think, to me, that was Google taking a strong stand.
Yeah, it was a big deal. And you know, I had a conversation with Ben and others about this. An example in conversation was climate change, and I've said this on the show before. But if your search was climate change, you got good results. But if your search was is climate change real, you got crappy results because Google wasn't, you know, relevance required that people who asked this question click on this. If you're stupid enough to ask this question, you're stupid enough to click on that, and those things rose. And there was a manipulation that occurred, a thumb on the scale that Google had to compensate for. And so, you know, in the end, Matt, I think that Google. If, so now, if you ask, is climate change real? Last I asked, it was good results. I haven't asked in a while. Google was kind of siding with the institution of science.
Well, I think Google's a huge believer in. I think Google is a huge believer in the scientific method, and that's a good way to get to truth, in general. but what's I don't know. What's kind of interesting to me is there's always been this tension between trying to make sure that things are well represented and reflect the web. So, you know, if somebody does a question, you want to reflect what the wisdom of the web sort of says. And so in that sense, you're like a mirror. But then there's also been this, I call it the evil unicorn problem. Everybody knows unicorns are awesome. They're fantastic. They're good. They're light. Nobody ever thinks of an evil unicorn, but you can still go to Google and type in evil unicorn and people expect something to show up. And so the wording that people use, like, is this, you know, product fake or, you know, is this a scam? Sometimes the people who might believe in something really strongly, you know, think about vaccines or something like that. Sometimes some people are really working hard to try to make sure they produce a lot of content in that area. And somebody else is like, well, we think there's a consensus, so we're not going to work that much to get our side of the story out. And so sometimes you do see those sorts of, you know, the landscape is not always what is on the web is not always what some people would consider reality.
You can see how hard this
is.
Though.
Right, right. The web is cracked.
Yeah.
But it's also certain phrases as well. There are certain phrases that are sort of defined by subgroups. And then they get redefined.
Yeah. I just searched for do vaccines cause autism? And the number one result is how do vaccines cause autism.com. So that's it. That's an example, kind of what you talked about, Jeff. I bet you, if I searched for vaccines, I'd get lots of
You
know,
this is the relevance
good
problem.
Science,
and it's also the problem of there's one scientific paper over here nobody's talking about, and there's 1,000 stupid blog posts a million people are talking about over here.
Yeah, how do you determine that?
The signals are wrong. However, Matt, you're right. If you do search for evil unicorns, it took me to Amazon, and you can buy an inflatable evil unicorn horn for cats.
I actually do have an evil unicorn action figure because I was going to do a blog post, but I'm off duty. I don't need to talk about evil unicorns anymore. So,
by the way, if you search for do dog vaccines cause autism, Google's very good about debunking that despite the leaks.
Actually, that first link is a search grabbing site, but don't click through because it swears.
Okay. This one is timed around a news story, which it sounds like fake news to me, that some Brooklyn denizens are not vaccinating their dogs against rabies and other serious diseases because they believe it causes autism in their dogs, which I believe that I don't believe there is such a thing. So I think that sounds like a fake news story,
but also there is actually an issue with vaccines and dogs because the problem is that they're not as thoroughly tested as they are on humans.
Right.
And also vets use them as a way to make an annual visit. So I have had a dog that's happened to where we were very conscientious and did what we were told and went to the vet every year and was given this cocktail of vaccines. And literally the vet gave the dog the annual checkup, said, "Oh, this dog's fine. Everything's great. Let me give this giant cocktail of vaccines." And then within a week it had an autoimmune disease. So the problem is they haven't, literally her lymph nodes grew up. She was really sick and she died within a month. Wow. It was really shocking for us. And since then we've been much more careful about that. But there is this vaccines are good, more vaccines are better thing that is slightly sketchy because the interactions between them haven't actually been tested.
I really don't want to come down on like vaccines are good or bad or dog vaccines are good or bad. I just want to point out like the people who feel strongly about a given topic will talk about something and then you can type anything into Google and we got to return 10 results or Google has to return 10 results. And so that leads to interesting situations.
Yeah, that's why it's so difficult. In fact, I think my attitude during this whole fake news thing was I don't want to see companies like Facebook and Google trying to determine what's true or not, because that's, I mean, admittedly, there's facts in the world, but...
Well, nobody wants to be the truth police,
but
there are...
You don't want to be the truth police either, exactly.
But there are some things that are...
But the thing is that, science...
Yes.
But the two things we've mentioned, I know we all agree that vaccines don't cause autism and that climate change is man-made. I know we all agree on that, but that is still debated. Is it Google or Facebook's place to weigh in on that?
I would argue no. I would argue that egregious, the bar should be even higher.
I would argue as well. And then we can all agree, there's not a colony of Martians, or a colony of moon denizens living on the moon. We can all agree on that. That's egregious.
Right.
But nobody's publishing stories like that because there's no money to be made on stories like that. That's the real problem, isn't it? I guess maybe the Weekly World News did for years with the alien babies and
I mean, I'm looking through the sites that we have on our project. You could debate this one, but I just put it a site called Truth Uncensored.net.
We should mention when you say our project, so everybody knows and Matt knows that. Craig,
I got you full disclosure yes, is I got $14 million from a combination of Craig Newmark, Facebook, the Ford Foundation, and other supporters. And we have independence in our governance, but you should know that by all means that I received those funds to give them back out in the cause of truth
and Jeff justice. Is one of the people who's doing this, which is, I think, fantastic. That's the News Integrity Project he's been mentioning.
This is why I want to have coffee with Matt, too, because I want to get his perspective about how this world operates.
So you have a dog in this hunt. I mean, this is something you spent a lot of time thinking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
But is it a vaccinated dog? Sorry. <I couldn't resist. laughs> I'm sorry. It's a serious topic. I didn't mean to be
It
polite,
is a serious but... topic. And actually, I think your point's well taken, too. Kevin loves his poodles.
I've got a dog here, the other three upstairs.
It's clear, of course, that dogs need to be vaccinated against rabies and, they're heartworm. And there are lots of things. And I think you make a good point. You can over-vaccinate out of greed.
Well, the point is more that puppies need to be vaccinated against it.
Right.
And dogs need a refresher at some interval.
Every 3 years for distemper, something like that. I can't remember what it was.
But the interval is not annually, and actually most vets will send you an annual thing because that's their way of getting you in the door.
I think we need to do a story on bad vets because I've run into bad vets as well. And I think
I could tell you about
our
ours.
Our dog was also, I think, ultimately killed by bad veterinary treatment. Our dog ended up having Ozzy ended up having a $10,000 back surgery that I think he didn't need and I think killed him. But that's another story for another day. So bad vets,
So, Leo, if you go to truthuncensored.net, I think, with your ad blocker off.
Okay.
Your ad blocker off.
Okay.
Do I really want to do that?
Yes.
Well, if you go down the second row of stories, for example, one story they have there is breaking. Government admits plan to microchip the population.
Yes, of course they do.
Right?
That's what they've wanted to do all along.
So I could argue about the credibility of this site. But for me, I have ads galore on this thing. Loft.
Yeah.
Zodiac strappy thong.
Scary dollar prediction. Scary Bitcoin prediction. No, I see them all. Here's Taboola. I see Taboola ads. See any Google ads on there, though?
No.
I don't see, I do get my ad choices link. I always love that. You do have a choice when it comes to ads.
That's not necessarily a Google. Oh, it's Google. That's AdSense.
Is that correct? I think it is. Yeah. So this would this here, the cameras saw it all. She wore very little, and you won't believe what she showed is a Google ad because I get the ad choices link on it. Unless somebody's spoofing that, which wouldn't surprise me.
Someone at the Googleplex right now is like, shut it down. Shut it all down.
Yeah. from the web, sponsored links. That's Taboola, right? Yeah, that's a Taboola.
Or one of them.
The scary Bitcoin predictions also has ad choices on it. Does that mean it's Google?
I think it does.
Yeah.
Click on that.
The link is to Google.
Not always.
No, it's googleadservices.com. Okay. That's the link. Google Ad Services.
One of them is,
redirect.
But another one.
Is that a real one?
When I hover over the link, it's www.googleadservices.com, and then, of course, the long extra stuff. So
you have that same arrow. That same arrow can appear on non-Google ads.
This is a Google ad.
There's Taboola here as well.
Yeah. Just because I'm telling – the link is through Google Ad Services. So Google has not pulled their ads from Truth Uncensored, the truth about political news. But this may be a political – see, I think this doesn't rise to the level Matt was talking about of egregiousness. Maybe it does.
Sometimes in the past we've seen somebody admit that they defrauded somebody or admit that a story was fake. Right. Like, there was a story about an 11 or a 13-year-old who like got money and like called in prostitutes to play Xbox with him. And it was all just this, you know, viral story that somebody concocted. And then the person admitted that they had, you know, deliberately done this as a fake story.
That's, I would say, is more slanted than fake. Liberal news outlets working overtime to cover huge Democratic scandals. You know, that kind of thing. So this is why it's so difficult, though, right? I mean, this is the challenge.
It is difficult. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just because you, from your political vantage point, may hate this doesn't necessarily mean it's fake news by any means. Mm-hmm. Fake news would have
to be... Though I do doubt that the government has been planning to microchip us all.
Well, that's true. Fake news would have to be demonstrably false. Right?
Just I don't.
Well... But here's the issue. So I've had people ask me, well, if it has, you know, if it's like 90% okay, is that okay? No, because they throw the 90% on of seemingly okay stuff to sneak the 10% by.
Yeah.
Let me give you another one. I'm gonna give up. This is real irreverent right now. If you go to my numbers section, you will see a fascinating link, I think, to the Russian Twitter propaganda dashboard.
Oh, I saw
dashboard.
This is amazing.
SecuringDemocracy.org. Yeah. This is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And it's a very legitimate organization that is going through but now, if you look at the...
It calls Sputnik and RT Russian propaganda.
It does. And also, the way this works is they identified Twitter accounts that were tied to Russian propaganda, and then they see what they are presenting.
Right.
And what domains and what stories.
Right.
And you see a big tie to this, to things like Breitbart and stuff.
Trending domains, iDrainTheSwamp.com, BigLeaguePolitics.com, WeaselZippers.us. I don't know what that's all about. Might have more to do with veterinarian vaccines. I don't know. But that's the first two are clearly Trump-focused. Top topics, Trump, U.S., Russia, Russian, Syria. But, you know, you could say that about if you were Washington Post. You know, covering Washington Post tweets, it would probably be the same ranking of those subjects.
Robert, I looked at this earlier today. There were other topics. I mean, Stephen Miller is big right now. Ben Rhodes, that story. That story is Ben Rhodes.
That's a part of outing story.
That's a part of the story that you're seeing that on the right. You do not see that all on the left.
Right.
I don't know why Howard Dean is on the list.
Well, he's become once again relevant. I don't know. It's very. This is really interesting. Do they assert really, that really how many bots do they think are Russian?
I think they're tracking 300 of them. Uh-huh. So I remember I went through their fact before, but
yeah,
can't find it now.
Dashboard tracking Russian propaganda on Twitter. Well, we you know
and Matt, I've on the show before. I've gone on at paranoid length, at tin hat length. I read the NATO.
They
just blocked him.
That fixes it, right, Kevin?
He said the magic words that caused this internet connection to drop out.
Well, I have this weird thing. If I do a Google search in my browser, Skype drops out in the background. I've no idea what's going on there.
Well, your Skype says, "Oh, you want some bandwidth for that browser? Let's do that. Let's do that instead." FTC has Epic has gone to the FTC to submit a complaint about this Google technology that we were talking about. Remember, we said that, and it was, the way it was written in the papers, it did sound pretty skeezy. Google would be able to tie your online ad viewing with your offline purchases using something called store sales measurement, a consumer profiling technique to track consumers who make offline purchases. The idea is to tell advertisers how effective their ads are. And, of course, you know, the way we do it on our shows generally is with what they call direct response. We give you a promo code that's got our name in it, or we give you a URL, you know, /twit. And the advertisers say, well, we got, you know, this many responses. So that's the tracking we do. But you can't. It's hard to do that in every case. Certainly a lot of Google ads don't. So this was designed, I think, by Google Sales to help advertisers understand how their ads were doing. You know, are you, you know, did you sell that car? You know, when Ford is on Twit, they can't say, well, we know we sold this many cars because of Twit without doing a lot of research. And Google hopes to help them with that. According to Google, it could track about 70% of all credit card and debit card transactions in the U.S. and tie them back to you, to, you know, the people who made them, to seeing those ads. Epic has filed with the FTC asking that they investigate this. Request for investigation, injunction, and other relief against this technology. We got him back. Jeff Jarvis is back. What do you think?
Well, it's one of these things. It's like they've been trying to do this for a long time, and there are lots of sketchy organizations in the U.S. that do this already. Experian, Equifax, and those guys are trawling all that data and trying to guess stuff about you.
Right.
For Google to tie up with that is, yeah, it's a little disappointing. They also have been doing Google Wallet / Android Pay / whatever it's called this week, and Apple has been doing a similar thing. And there's this set of, like, if we can track all the payments, we can keep track of all this stuff. But a lot of it is based on sort of guessing correlations. And in fact, most of the Equifax stuff is sort of bad big data correlation stuff. Now, Google is better at that than those companies are, and so could do a better job of correlating that stuff. So there may be a case for being a little more nervous about it. But in practice, we already gave up this thing when we accepted credit ratings, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years
Good
ago.
Point.
Yeah. This is Yarnania's point, is that the Turing test was passed at the point where we started doing stupid things with our credit to try and locate an algorithm somewhere at Equifax. I did this when I moved to America from the UK with a large amount of money because I just sold a house. But did I have a credit rating? Did I? Hell. And I had to go and see a guy and said, oh, yeah, borrow this, pay it back, back. Do these six things. Now you have a credit rating.
We tell
now
college kids to do this. We do.
Yeah. And it's basically somebody's reverse engineered the heuristic that these, you know, 1980s mainframe algorithms are trying to do. So, you know, there is a problem here, but the problem is not Google's giant AI or, you know, any of this stuff. It is that we have sort of delegated our judgment to the machines, and even a really bad algorithm will let us do that. And that's the bigger problem than, you know, the AI taking over the world problem. It's the, do we actually understand what we're doing here, or are we just guessing? And that's the piece that makes me more nervous. So, you know, specifically going after Google is, let's keep an eye on them and make sure they're behaving well. They will probably try really hard to behave well because they're smart and they realize this is a problem, whereas a lot of the other companies will be doing less of that. But the real answer is legislation about this and, you know, holding them to account in public. And the thing that's happening in this realm is, I don't know how much we've talked about the GDPR stuff a little bit on the show, but that's the sort of ticking time bomb that's happening in Europe, which is actually writing new regulations about what you can do about profiling and tracking user data and making sure people have actually consented to their data being tracked. And that's a big change that's going through at the moment. And in the UK, everyone I'm talking to is thinking about this and saying, how do we make our stuff compliant with this? I mean, in the US, they're still going a bit, but it's actually, you know, there is legislation that is going to come into effect next year that has actual teeth in it about tracking user data in the EU.
Meanwhile, the government admits a plan to microchip the population. Oh, no, sorry. I'm excited. This is a good story. So, that's an interesting conundrum, I guess. I'm a bad guy to ask about this stuff because I don't really care.
but of course, you know, you're comfortable enough you can get away with it. And also, you gave up on your privacy years ago, and
right? Right.
Coasting on the other end of this.
Yeah. So I'm really I can't use my own feelings about this as a way to judge it.
No, exactly. But part of the problem, that is a structural problem too, in that a lot of the people who are making the decisions about this are people who are well off and live in Silicon Valley and have a fairly comfortable life and haven't actually hit the issues.
Exactly right. Yep.
And that's the structural thing that yep. they don't actually have the ability to imagine exactly the problems that right. you have. If
they're not getting denied credit. That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't have access to credit. You don't have access to banking. If you're trying to deal everything in cash, work with this, that's hard.
I don't mind if an advertiser knows that I bought something based on an ad I saw in a Google ad. And if that helps, not Google, but if it helps the website that's running the Google ad, I don't think that's a bad thing. But again, I'm kind of quasi in the advertising business. We sell advertising. That's what keeps us afloat. But I can understand why an advertiser would want to know that. And I don't feel like so here's the nub of it. And I'll let Jeff argue this too, maybe. But what is the harm in Google connecting these data points?
Well, the harm
goes after privacy all the time, but I think the real question here is that this is an advertiser benefit, a media benefit. You know, at the same time, up a couple spots in the rundown is Ray Kurzweil is writing your emails for you because Google is still reading your emails.
I didn't realize
your emails for ads anymore.
I had no idea that Ray Kurzweil, the great artificial intelligence scientist, is on the smart reply team.
Yeah, so they're reading your email to write replies, and we're cool with that because that's a great service to us, right? I don't hear any complaints about that. People love it. Yeah. The thing about the ad value, which is going to maybe save media.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Google stopped doing ads out of reading email, but now they're writing replies for you, and I'm using it.
Hell yeah.
No, and it is useful, sure. So the thing I would look to, mathbabe.org, you know Cathy O'Neill.
Love she's written Cathy O'Neill. We've interviewed her.
Weapons of Math Destruction. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's really good on this stuff because she's actually thought about it at depth and written it well in ways people can understand. And written about the idea, you know, basically it's model failure. It's people who are building very naive models and then somehow getting them baked into the way we experience the world.
Right.
And that's the piece that's wrong with this. And the answer is not give up modeling. The answer is give up better models and have more transparent models. So the GDPR stuff for me is that I think that's an encouraging step because it's basically saying, okay, you can do this stuff, but you've got to get people to agree to it, and you've got to explain it in a way they can actually understand. So you've got to get consent from people to what kind of data manipulations you're going to do on their data. And that is different from, you know, the classic, you know, Google worldview was, we'll grab all the data and try and make sense of it later. Because you know, that works for the web, and that model was extended to personal data as well, with the, you know, the obvious, like the drive-by Wi-Fi scraping and things like that we've talked about before. And that having some kind of stop and think about that a bit is like don't be evil. It's saying think about the consequences of what you're doing and make sure that you can explain this to the person whose data you're tracking. And that's, you know,
well, that's so this is very different
in line with
what Kathy O'Neill is saying. Is not that it's bad to gather the data, nor is it bad to analyze it. It's just bad to use bad models. But I don't think Epic is saying that. Epic's saying, no, you shouldn't be collecting this data at all.
But that is also part of this as well.
This
part
goes
of it
back
is,
to the
what should you default to?
Right.
You know, there's the, if you listen to Mache and Cory Doctorow, there is the personal data is like, you know, toxic waste. You've got to be careful about how you handle it. You've got to make sure you don't spill it anywhere. There's a lot of overhead to that, and do you really want to be dealing with this if you don't actually understand it? There was an example in the UK. My example is Wetherspoons, which is a big pub chain in the UK, recently deleted their entire email database because they were worried there might be a breach. They're worried about the GDPR stuff coming, and actually most of their business, people walking through the door with cash and having an email list, was not giving them much benefit from that. And so from their point of view, it's like, this isn't worth the pain of this, and which is very different from a business
but it,
like
but it
Google,
is worth it in other ways. All I want to say is, I think with the examples you just gave, it's the Dana Boyd rule.
Why is MIT's Uh-oh. Bandwidth not working? of all the places.
I'll take over for Jeff. I'll be substitute.
Jeff, Matt. That's good.
Okay, if I were a substitute, Jeff, I understand probably from Google's perspective, they think their advertising is very effective, and so showing that this drives offline sales is something that they would really want to do so that people don't waste their $100 million of brand advertising, you know, on stuff that doesn't work.
Right.
But it depends on how much of this is in aggregate, because I'm very mindful
Google
of
says
like
it's all in aggregate, by the way. Google says it's not. There's no individual information being exposed.
That's good, because you know, I'm just mindful. Like, if I'm channeling Stacy, here we have a group of four white guys, and yet if you think about an ad like Bail Bonds DC, you know, if you can track who clicks on that and then see what the offline usage of that, then you start to learn something about people that are vulnerable. And I would that's where it edges into something that I would worry about. So if they're only doing aggregate data, then that makes
sense. So I'll raise a couple of the issue there, which is the generally agreed wisdom that there's no such thing as anonymization, and that as soon as you're aggregating the data, you can't really anonymize the data. Do you reject that, Matt? You probably have more experience.
Well, that was a DEF CON story this week, wasn't it? Somebody set themselves up. I want to try to find the story. Somebody set themselves up as a data broker and got a lot of consumer data, I think in Germany, which Jeff would enjoy. And then identified politicians by looking for their names in the data because
this has happened over and over.
They had search URLs, things like that.
Yeah. New York Magazine had an article quoting the Guardian story: 3 billion URLs from 3 million German users in a database. These researchers acquired it by pretending to be a marketing company. Yeah, and they demonstrated that it was not so difficult to de-anonymize it. And we've seen this before many times.
Right.
Matt. So I agree with you. If it's an aggregate, what's the harm? I mean, we look at statistics all the time. And, you know, it's funny because there was a great post on Medium. I'll see if I can find it about privacy that pointed out the first U.S. Census was posted publicly. Everything that was known in the U.S. Census. But that was more so people could check to make sure it was accurate.
It's open sourced. Yeah.
It was open sourced. So
Well, they still had Hastings voting then as well, didn't they?
Yeah, our conception of privacy, human conception of privacy, has changed considerably over the years. This was actually a really good post about the history of privacy. Let's see if I can find it
from Yonatan. Yeah,
yeah, you saw it. Yeah,
no, from
The birth and death of privacy: 3,000 years of history, told through 46 images by Greg Fahrenstein.
Greg's, yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's on Medium. And it was great, and it really showed that, you know, what we think of as kind of a human right and a human need was really not acknowledged as either a need or a right until fairly recently. For instance, people didn't even read silently until 1215, when the church mandated confessions for the masses. People shared beds until around 1700 because they were so expensive. You know, in fact, it was a problem in hospitals because they were having all the patients, like 12 to a bed. Vint Cerf says privacy may, and I remember him talking about this, may actually be an anomaly. This might be something we only now have started thinking about. But we assume that this forever has been, you know, how it is. So yeah. Really well worth reading this article, at least to jog your thinking on this. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's easy to read because there's lots of pictures. I like that. And video. This is video from a movie called Beowulf. Oh, it's not available. They pulled it down. Of all the people sleeping together in the hut. There's some adult images in here, by the way.
The 3D Beowulf?
Yeah, the ugly, horrible 3D Beowulf. You know what? I think Greg is just trying to make this exciting. I think they're just trying to make this exciting. But let's get back to this issue. Do you feel, Matt, as a data scientist, I'm sure that's some of your training, that you can aggregate data, anonymize it, and use it effectively?
I think... probably what Google is after, my guess, is the top line.
Yes.
You know, which is, you know, 70% of offline purchases are influenced in some way. And I suspect that is the most effective thing for what they're trying to do. And I would trust that they would be trying to combine this data in an ethical way.
Nobody doubts that that's what Google's after. The issue is, do they inadvertently leak information like bail bond, people who go to bail bondsmen, inadvertently, is that information potentially inadvertently leaked in this process?
I'd have to look into that more to have a strong opinion. But it is the case that a lot of the times you think you can anonymize data, and it turns out people come up with a really creative way to slice it in a different way, and then they de-anonymize it. Yes. So,
but that's,
we also
have the
to look
issue,
at the cost of not allowing this. That at some point media is going to have to prove its value to advertisers, and this is a way to do that. It's a holy grail. And to have advertiser support for so much that we love in media, this may be necessary at some level.
Right. Well, and it's funny. It's a holy grail for digital advertising companies like ours. It is exactly what television and radio don't want you to do, because they don't really want you to know how few of your ads are actually doing anything at all.
Yeah.
So. But the other part of this is, in order to do this well, you have to have enough data points to do realistic stats. You know, you can't do A/B testing without enough data to know if they're statistically significant or not.
I think you have to acknowledge big data is going to happen. It's happening. It's done. There's no turning the clock back on that.
No, but the thing is you know, the problem is that all this media stuff is powered or distributed. So unless you are actually at very large scale, you're not going to be able to extract good enough data to get anonymization out of it. Yeah. You know, that is the challenge. If you've only got a few hundred referrals, you can't really do much with that, because that's not enough to do any breakdown on it.
Right. All right. We're going to leave these giant questions.
If you get a few hundred people buying Ford cars from the show, then we're doing well.
Right. Ford was very happy. They were very happy. But, you know, actually, I always end up talking about our business on this show. I don't know why. But just a little peek behind the scenes, the way you do that if you're Ford or some other, you know, Procter & Gamble brand advertiser, is you with research. You call people. Say, do you remember, did you ever listen to a show called, you know, and they'll give you five shows. Do you remember any of the advertisers on there? They call that unaided recall. And if you get a high score, then it worked. They can't measure sales. It's too big a company to measure sales. Google has actually, this is a good one for Matt too, is experimenting with the Search Console. What is Search Console, Matt?
if it's what I'm thinking of, there's the Webmaster Tools, which became the Webmaster Console, and then Webmaster, like, who calls them webmasters anymore? So now you can have a Search Console. I mean, it's nice to have a channel where Google can give information back to you and get information from people, so that if you are trying to give some structured information, you know, here's a place where you can do it. You can make sure there's no syntax errors, that sort of thing.
So there, this is the original the original tools. This is funny on Search Console.
Ooh, wow, wow.
Going back in time a little bit here, but these
2006.
Kinds of six. Yeah, this is probably this is right about your time, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah. Vanessa Fox was a person who, and there was a great team up in Washington State that worked on this, the initial version.
Yeah, I remember this stuff. Mm-hmm. So they have they now have more than 24 reports. They've got lots of useful tools. And they've added two new ones, or an extensive redesign to show you more actionable insights, better supportive workflow, faster feedback loops between you and Google. And the new beta features are, I don't know what any of this means, but since Matt's here, I'm going to bring it up. Index coverage report and AMP fixing flow. Oh, somebody's buzzing like crazy. Who's that? Is that Matt?
Not it's me.
Unplug and replug, Matt.
Is it me? No.
I'm going to give you the signal.
I think did we hit the hour spot? Is that what it is?
Could be. It's 59 minutes into the show. 59 minutes and 48 seconds. And now we can't hear him.
You say happens.
Uh-oh. Oh, no. You can't hear me?
Now you're back. Yeah, you're back.
Oh, now we're back.
That was us. I guess we muted you so that you wouldn't buzz us. So index coverage report shows count of index pages, information. I remember this from Webmaster Tools. This is like what Google knows about you, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many pages have been crawled and are in Google's index?
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's cool. And then what is AMP fixing flow? Oh, this is about issues with your site. Ah, okay. Fix the AMP issue. Yeah.
This is the unvalidated thing. Yeah.
Okay. God, I hate Skype. We're just going to shoot Skype right now and put it out of its misery. Thank you, Microsoft. Job well done. Goodbye. Actually, Jeff's not using Skype. He's using another technology called IPDTL, and it's just as bad. So you know what?
Ip-diddle.
Why did I think I could do a network of a broadcast network with people over IP, voice over IP. Why did I think that?
Do you go through this in the other shows, or is it just us? Is it just me?
Lately, it's been happening more with Skype. It's been happening a lot with Skype.
Really?
Actually, you know, I mean, it would in the early days of Twit, it was the worst. It was horrible. I would spend hours trying to fix the audio after every show. Facebook is tweaking its mobile news feed to prioritize fast loading pages.
Oh, hello.
Google's done that, of course, with its search results.
Mm-hmm. So, are they going to support AMP pages, or are they just going to support the ones?
That's interesting. Yeah,
their random mockup.
Even Facebook's Instant Articles is adopting AMP.
Yeah, you can now write once, publish twice.
Facebook says, we've heard from people that it's frustrating to click on a link that leads to a slow-loading web page. No kidding.
Yeah, I think.
In fact, even more broadly on the internet, we've found that when people have to wait for a site to load for too long, they abandon what they were clicking on altogether. Yep. As many as 40% of website visitors abandon a site after 3 seconds. God, I bet you that I would love to see that number over time. Like, was it 5 seconds 10 years ago? Is it 4 seconds?
And yeah.
Is it going to be 1 second next year? And I bet that number's going down. We are so impatient. So the social network will soon take into account the estimated load time of a web page that someone clicks to from a news feed and prefer pages that load faster.
I'm sure it's a second order effect, but it's still probably pretty useful in the sense that this is something like everybody would prefer a faster website over a slower website, you know, and it pushes all the sites of the web in order, you know, to behave better. It's not like that has a particular ideological bent or anything like that. It's like, no, everybody wants the web to be faster. So it seems like a healthy thing to push those sort, or, you know, to have encryption so that everybody knows, you know, their connection is secure. It's just good behavior.
But it is a little bit, in this age of net neutrality, a little bit of a disadvantage to sites that don't have the resources or on shared servers. They may be saying something very important that deserves to show up in search results or deserves to show up in the news feed, but they can't be as fast as, you know, the News Corp because they don't have the resources, right?
Well, you can what junks up the pages so much is ads and trackers and other things.
Yeah.
So you can create a simple web page.
Oh, TV images.
That's the easy part, no?
Yeah. I mean, you could. You know, you mentioned the webmaster. Google has a tool called Lighthouse that's quite good at this. You throw it at your website and it says, "No, that's a bit slow. Have you tried changing this to this?"
Right.
And it's like the webmaster, but more focus, a more speed focused version of that, rather than a are you checking the boxes on our indexing thing? And it will tell you to make a progressive web app because that's, you know, part of what its job is. But it will actually give you a prioritized list of. These images are loading really slowly, or these images are really big. You should make them smaller, or this CSS is loading really slowly. Do you want to check where you're serving that from? So it will actually do that kind of profiling for you,
Let me just try Lighthouse on our page.
It's a Chrome plugin.
Yeah, I got it. I'm just worried that it's going to be really, really bad news.
Well, it does load it three times. It loads it like with different windows.
Yeah, that's the mobile version because it's a small window. Oh God! I'm depressed.
Oh dear!
I'm really depressed.
You need to do some image variants there. Those are loading slowly.
Lord above, Lord above.
Now check Matt's vet site.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, but the vets.gov is doing great.
Well, and there's probably some adoption curve where you can say in the early days, you don't want to, you know, speed to be that strong of a factor. It's definitely a second or even third order effect. But even including it as a factor makes people say, you know what? I should start paying attention to this. So even if it doesn't get that much weight in Facebook's algorithm, to have people see that and hear that means that now it's on their mind, it's on their radar, and they're like, well, I can't just wait 30 seconds for my pages to load. I have to at least think about right. that.
Well, I got a 97% for accessibility. That's good. But performance only 69, and in fact, everything else sucks. I didn't register a service worker. Oh, you don't even want to know. Does not respond with a 200 when offline. I don't know what that. User will not be prompted to install the web app. What? Is not configured for a custom splash screen.
That's the AMP stuff. Just scroll beyond that.
That's AMP. I don't care
progressive
about
web
that.
Progressive web app stuff, which is good, but it isn't the performance tab is the next one
this
down.
This is
which
the one
is actually,
I care about.
We look at first, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. First actually, meaningful paint, 4.7 milliseconds, 4.7 seconds. First interactive.
Actually, vets.gov, I got a 5 seconds there, so
all right.
Maybe it doesn't work for the UK as well.
Yeah, best practices, 5 failed audits. Oh, Lord, I don't care anymore. Goodbye. Goodbye, Lighthouse. I guess I'm not going to rank up there on Facebook. I mean, do you worry about that at all? I mean, I understand that you can do things to speed up a site, but...
It's useful to look at these things because it will often say, oh, you've got this one image there, and you're like,
no,
oh,
that I understand. And certainly if you have something important to say on your blog, you should probably use Lighthouse and so forth. I just worry that algorithms will prioritize pages that load in less than 2 seconds, and that will leave out a lot of the most interesting, valuable
stuff.
That's
a good point.
I'm not as worried about that because, like, we would get questions about that at search conferences at Google, and somebody would say, well, my website takes 5 seconds to load. And a lot of what people don't realize is some web pages take 60 seconds to load. Like,
that's
we have
bad.
Seen, yeah. Like, I think one of the reasons healthcare.gov looked like, or some sites looked like they were broken, is we recently ran into a website where it took 5 minutes for the page to load. So, of course, everybody was like, well, it's not working, wow. So I'll just hit reload, which then just made things worse. So people don't realize just how bad some websites can be. So maybe there's something that would say if you're more than 30 seconds to load or 25 seconds to load, then, okay, we ding you by some small amount so that we look for better alternatives.
You should ask Joe Ito about this, Jeff, while you're there at the MIT's Media Lab. Google and MIT's new machine learning algorithms retouch your photos before you take them?
This is pretty cool.
What?
The algorithm is now so tight, it can check, it can adjust the photo before you take it.
So, wow. So, wow.
Oh, so it can do it in the viewfinder.
It's doing it the whole time you're looking at whatever you're looking, in case you take a picture.
Yeah.
Wow. Computational photography is amazing. I don't agree, however, with Vic Gundotra.
This is fascinating.
Who says I should ditch my DSLR, my thousands of dollars of cameras, because frankly the iPhone is all you need. Now this is
and never buy an Android.
Never buy it. This is so, now remember, okay, the story of Vic Gundotra is he worked at Microsoft, worked then at Google working with Apple on the Google apps for the iPhone. Was this apparently a great advocate for Google and social, and you know, prodded Larry Page till he set up Google Plus, then left. He's currently at Cardia, which is one.
Well, he was also kind of Mr. Mobile at Google
in
too.
Between. Then I left out of stage, and then he left and he's founded Cardia, which we've talked about. We really like.
It's one of
the few medical devices with FDA approval. He posted. Okay, so I'm thinking he's throwing shade at his old employer because, first of all, he posted this not on Google Plus but on Facebook, right?
Yeah.
And then he says, I love my iPhone so much, I'm getting rid of my DSLR, and one should never use an Android phone again.
He added that in the comments. He was goaded into it, but yeah. Scoble was goading him on.
Scoble was the one who said, oh, I gave my expensive Canon systems to some filmmakers just because of this. I love the shot. Of course, and he's showing off two pictures of his daughters, Vic's daughters, using the portrait feature in the iPhone. But as many have pointed out, portrait does a terrible job. It only is impressive if you're not a pro or pixel peeping or really paying attention. The knot in her hair is strangely out of focus in this picture is just one example. He created quite a storm, and I loved reading the there's one response from Android Central, but I loved reading the comments back and forth. I mean, as you said, Scoble completely agreed. There were a number of people who said, are you kidding? The Pixel
there were some
phone,
other prominent people in that argument.
Yeah, the Pixel has a far better camera than the iPhone, and I think many agree.
The Pixel itself takes good pictures. I've been taking some very pleasant pictures with this thing.
Seems like Vic's biggest interest here was in iPhone's portrait mode, but I think the point was made that with two lenses, the iPhone 7 Plus can do things that a single lens camera like the Pixel XL can't do. I don't know.
Yeah, and that's gonna I've been writing about that for years. Yeah, sure, more lenses helps because then you can do synthetic aperture stuff. That's very cool.
The real takeaway here is how powerful computational photography is, I think.
Yeah, and that's only going to get more true.
Yeah.
And as we throw more sensors, we're going to be having more sensors on our phones over time for lots of reasons. And they get cheaper and cheaper, and being able to do this will make more sense. And it's like the MIT thing is part of that. But, even just the way HDR works now is like that too. The stuff that, the stuff that this phone does with HDR, because it can do it quick enough that there's no motion blur, is actually is very impressive.
Here's a picture posted by a photographer, Matthias Appel, from his Nikon D7000 DSLR. He says to Vic, well, then it should be no problem to recreate this with your iPhone. Is that a lemur? I don't know what it is, but it is an amazing shot. And you probably couldn't do that with a camera.
It's a lemur with a very long zoom as well.
Yeah, long zoom. Yeah.
So, Matt, do you miss dog fooding?
Yeah.
I miss dog fooding so much, but I still have my Pixel XL. I'll throw out one computational photography idea, which I have not had time to do, which is if you can control the focus plane in software from your camera, you could imagine marching your focus plane forward,
right,
and basically doing a 3D reconstruction of a scene using only the regular camera. Wow. So if something had enough stuff, you could actually do that. So if somebody wants to write a fun app, just cycle through the focal planes see what is, you know, at most focus at each range, and you could probably reconstruct a poor man's 3D version of a scene.
Or do what the Lytro does, which is a very expensive camera that effectively does that and allows you to choose what part is in focus after the fact.
Well, so that's what Facebook was showing at F8, too,
right.
was recreating a 3D scene from the image. Yeah.
And that does, as you, that's really interesting, Matt. You're absolutely right. You don't need two lenses for that or special depth sensing or anything like that. Just You just need to take a lot of pictures fast, which we already are doing.
Mm-hmm. But Android has had that as lens blur for about 4 years now, but now it's actually practical. It used to be you had to be really careful and go, move it up,
right.
Whereas now I can... You know, I can grab a photo of my microphone and go, oh, I want the microphone in focus. I want the glass in focus.
Right.
And it just switches between them.
Right.
And that's with one lens. If you had two or three lenses on here, which obviously you will have soon, then you can do that in real time. And you could actually do the MIT thing of do it in the viewfinder and pick your focal plane there. Because actually these things have depth of field. You know, they're basically little tiny pinhole cameras. They got huge depth of field, but often what you want is to pull the stuff out from the foreground and the background. And if you've got more lenses, you can do that. So yeah, this is obviously coming in next year's or this year's phones as they come out this year. You know, at the end of the year, we're going to have many more little cameras in there because it's the obvious thing to do next. And that will mean, hey, you know, firstly, it's, you know, the obvious thing to do first is to put two in so you can do stereoscopic photography, and you can shoot video where you've got a 3D thing. That, and everyone's been shipping 3D headsets for 2 years. You know, Apple's talking about AR. Google's been talking about it for a year, so that's obviously going to happen too. But the other part of that is if you just by putting more lenses on there, you can do this kind of image process and do some very powerful things with it. So yeah, that's clearly going to be shipping this year.
Yeah, you know, it's not just in phones, by the way. My wife shoots. I shoot a big full-frame cameras. I just got the Sony A9, which is a really interesting, complicated sensor that's stacked. There's all sorts of things. But my wife shoots a Micro Four Thirds. She's using Olympus OMD. And it is getting amazingly high-quality images. And I'm convinced this is computational photography from a much smaller sensor. The clarity, the detail, is as good as any full sensor. So this kinds of computational photography is also migrating into cameras, and cameras with small sensors, bigger than a phone sensor, but with small sensors relative to the big DSLRs, are doing remarkable jobs. This Olympus blows me away every single time. I can't believe the images.
You will still get better results with a good lens on the front of it.
Glass is glass. You can't. Physics is always going to be there, but you can create you with computational. So
you can do amazing
you
things with
correct.
Yes.
Correct for bad
Absolutely.
Glass, right?
Yeah, and I just put a link in the chat. You know, the stuff that the HDR does now is just like, okay, I'm going to take a photograph of my dogs in a cornfield in front of the sunset, and all of it is exposed.
That's gorgeous. And what a great shot!
And I could not do that with, you know, I could not do that with film without sitting there for a long time thinking about it, or actually bracketing and then mixing it afterwards.
I would just say because if you say all of this is happening on the camera phone. It's also happening to the same degree on bigger cameras, more expensive cameras, maybe even to a greater degree. You're seeing amazing stuff being done.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And also, you're starting to see it done at, you know, at 4K video resolution as well, which is the other sort of freaky thing about this.
Right.
The stuff that you can do with that now is quite amazing.
Yeah. I mean, people, I think, well, but the phone is a computer. But absolutely these days, if you're buying a DSLR, you're buying a computer that happens to have a sensor and pieces of glass in front of it, but it's just as much of a computer. That's a beautiful shot. Was that a single shot done in camera HDR?
Let me see what it says. Hang on. It was I'm pretty sure it was HDR. Yeah.
It's got to be. It's got to be HDR. I can see in the info here.
Yeah.
Pixel XL.
It says
F2.
F2. 1/2000th. ISO 51.
Yeah. It doesn't actually say whether it's HDR. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, the thing is, it has. It by default it's HDR auto now, so we'll actually just guess whether it needs it or not.
It's clearly HDR. I mean, if you look at the lower right corner and compare it to the upper left, the brightness
there's a brightness range there.
Much larger than the human eye, I'm sure. Hey, let's take a little break. We got lots more. Kevin Marks is visiting us from Middlesbrough, UK. Did I say that right?
Middlesbrough, yeah.
Middlesbrough, UK.
Middlesbrough.
Middlesbrough. where he and his poodles have migrated to be closer to his sons. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it because I know it's late at night here. There, it's almost midnight, right? We'll get done by midnight. I promise.
11:35. Yeah.
Yeah. Also with us, all the way from MIT, Jeff Jarvis. You look like with the lights behind you. You that headphone could be a halo. You could be Jesus.
Of course it is.
Yeah. Yeah. He's the Jesus of the journalists, Jeff Jarvis, BuzzMachine.com, and a professor of journalism. You got to send this picture to your students at the City University of New York, where he teaches journalism. And also joining us,
I think I'll draw on the whiteboard during the break.
We're thrilled to have him, Matt Cutts of the U.S. Digital Service, USDS.gov, where he is doing great work as the acting administrator. Helping websites and technology in the government get better and faster. And gosh, it's great to see you again after, it seems like, a year. You having fun? Are you enjoying yourself?
I wouldn't say it's fun, but it's very meaningful.
That's almost better, right? Fun is overrated. Fun is like Elon Musk saying, I couldn't hang out on the beach. I'd go crazy. I need stimulus. Satisfaction is fun in the long run.
Right. It's important work.
Yeah. So. You must feel good about that. That's
how's living in D.C., Matt?
D.C. is a pretty great city. I haven't been on the eastern seaboard in a while, and so there's a lot to do. There's, you know, good food these days. And I will say the U.S. Digital Service has a lot of transient people coming from across the country, and so we do some fun things from escape rooms to karaoke to game nights.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a good group.
How many people are there at the USDS?
It's a little less than 200.
Oh, it's
and
big.
We're split halfway between different agencies versus headquarters. We've got groups at Veterans Affairs, Health and Human Services, a bunch of Department of Homeland Security, the Pentagon, a bunch of different places.
So when you start working with one of these agencies, you send a SWAT team and they get headquartered over at the agency to do the work. Yeah. Yep. And are you getting new assignments? Have things slowed down? I mean, who's running you? Are you part of the Department of Commerce?
So we technically sit in the Office of Management and the Budget, which is in the Executive Office of the President. Yeah. Okay. But what tends to happen is something blows up or something is on fire. So, for example, if military families want to move across the country and that system is not performing, then we'll come in and say, okay, what can we do to figure out how to improve that? And then we also have some engagements that we've been doing for quite a while that are continuing that are really important and impactful stuff as well.
USDS just sent off its report to Congress a few days ago, so you can read more about this on the website at usds.gov.
And we are looking for tech folks. So
are you?
If you're interested.
Nice.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Nice.
If I had a good product manager, designer, engineer, like $100 million plus projects we could make a difference on right now.
Yeah. And there's information about how much you've saved our government at it-dashboard.gov, and it looks like you're saving us some money, some significant money. I like that. I like that a lot.
We're pretty good value.
But it's not just about saving money. It's about improving services, right?
No, but if you're going to get budget,
of course.
You know, you're going to get Congress to fund you. You got to show them this. See?
Yeah. Technology is one of those areas where the services can get better and they can get cheaper. Usually you don't get both of those.
Yeah, isn't that nice? Yeah. Does the Donald ever drop by?
I have been in a room with the president two or three times.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does he know what you do?
So we work with an office called the Office for American Innovation. So Jared Kushner and Chris Liddell, who's the former CFO of Microsoft, and that group of folks absolutely realizes the importance of making sure that technology works well in the government.
So how politicized is it? Do you feel like you're above the fray? You don't have to really worry about the politics going on?
We're a nonpartisan group.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The one thing that everybody can agree on is government technology should work better. And we spend way too much and we don't get services that are what you would expect on a Google or an iPhone or, you know, a Facebook website. And so if you can use your phone and see how good it is and then try to use a government, you know, piece of technology and see how bad it is, that's something that everybody agrees needs to work better.
If you go to USDS.gov, there's a join us button. And and if you are, you know, maybe looking at a sabbatical at your cushy job at Google or something like that, you maybe want to spend some of that time in D.C. helping things run better for the people. I like that. Thank you for your service, Matt. We appreciate it.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our show today brought to you by, we'll have more. We have lots more to talk about. We got to get it going here. Our show today brought to you by Cloudflare. Talk about service. This is, Cloudflare is on a mission to build a better internet. You know, I've talked to the folks at Cloudflare. It's so great because they say, because I try to tell you everything Cloudflare does. And they say, you know, you don't have to say everything because it goes on and on and on. Cloudflare is an amazing company. Of course, we're good friends with John Graham Cumming, their CTO. We've talked to many of the folks, including Mark Rogers at Cloudflare. He's their security guy. Some of the smartest people in the world work at Cloudflare. They want, they, you know, the initial benefit to you is they can make your site or your app faster. They can make it safer because, in effect, they have a web application firewall. I'll tell you how that works. It's amazing. They can make it more reliable. So you're protected against DDoS. You're protected against inadvertent DDoS, the /dot effect, you know, where a lot of people go to your site all at once. You can stop worrying if you use Cloudflare about slow loading page times, downtime, about getting hacked. It's easy to use. You can sign up in 5 minutes. And can I tell you something? There is a free tier that is really, really good. One of the reasons Cloudflare offers this protection to you for free, see, $0 a month over on the left, is because by being a part of the Cloudflare network, you help them provide a more useful web application firewall with a massive IP reputation database that updates for everybody, the free people and the paid people. So it's really valuable. Of course, Cloudflare's security team, starting with Mark, is constantly watching 24/7 for vulnerabilities, deploying real-time protection. I know a lot of you know about their DDoS protection, but they also give you IPv6, which can make a huge difference in your performance and on a mobile app. I mean, just boom, like that. They have a CDN, 115-plus data centers worldwide, which caches your content, moves it closer to your customers. That'll speed you up. I mean, I can go on and on. You know, we've got something actually really great. If you're interested in Cloudflare, if you go to cloudflare.com/twit, they are offering a webinar with their absolute, one of their best support engineers. He's really great at talking about this, Jameson Sundell, and explaining it. And you can be part of it. Ask questions. Find out what Cloudflare can do for you. All you have to do is go to cloudflare.com/twit. Give him your name and email, and you'll register for a session with Jameson. It's fantastic. I can, you know, if you're using cloud solutions like AWS or Google Cloud or Azure, Cloudflare can help you work with all of them and eliminate lock-in. So you can use more than one provider. And then if you decide to move on, you're not locked in. It goes on and on. This is a great company doing amazing technical work and helping websites everywhere. Cloudflare.com/twit. Find out more by talking to Jameson Sundell. Prices range from free to $20 a month to $200 a month. And, of course, as you get bigger, you're going to want an enterprise plan, and they can work with you on that too. Don't get hit by DDoS. Don't get hit with security flaws. Work better for your customers. It's a win all around at cloudflare.com/twit. And we thank them so much for their support of This Week in Google. Let's see. What else should we talk about here? Here's a surprise. The YouTube TV. I actually have been paying for this, and I love it. It's $35 a month. I get my locals in San Francisco. 2 million downloads for this cord cutter app. That means, I don't know how, they don't say how many subscriptions, but that's pretty amazing. That's at least 2 million people trying it. YouTube, according to Sensor Tower, 700,000 new installs since the announcement last week that was entering new markets. So I think people are kind of waiting. Can we get the local stations from YouTube TV? And when you can, it really is a good deal. I really like it. This ties into an article I thought, I'm reading The Onion. But it wasn't The Onion. It was The Wall Street Journal. Did you see this article? Millennials unearth an amazing hack to get free TV. The antenna. they quote, I got to sign in because it's behind a paywall, but they quote some millennials who say, I had no idea that all this free programming was out there, and all I had to do was get us some rabbit ears. I don't know.
Well, I did this last year, the year before, when I was in San Jose. It was like, okay, I don't actually need to pay cable for TV because I have Netflix and Amazon. And if I just stick a thing on the wall, I can get the live stuff that the cable providers can give me. And that's done. And in the UK, it's, you know, it's even better. But the digital over-the-air stuff here is actually really good. And all the channels have, you know, there's iPlayer for the BBC, there's an ITV app, there's a Channel 4 app, there's a Channel 5 app, so all the channels are competing to give you digital versions of their stuff too. So when I buy a TV here, it says give me an internet connection, give me an over the air connection, and I'll give you what you can find out of both. So it's, you know, it's already happened here, and the US lags a bit because there are these monopoly cable providers who are trying to persuade you that you need to pay them $200 a month to do this for you. So yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That's kind of the joke of it, is that, look, I didn't have to go to the cable company to get all these free sites. It's amazing. It's incredible. I can't understand why the Wall Street Journal wrote this article, to be honest with you. I really did think I must be reading the Onion here. Shows a millennial family watching television.
But it's part of this is like, oh, mock, you know, let's mock millennials. There was some guy today
maybe
saying,
that's it, yeah,
millennials tell me they don't answer the doorbell unless someone texts them first. And it's like, well, and it's like, yes.
Yeah, what's wrong with millennials, that?
You're a journalist in London. The millennials in your office are living like, you know, six to a flat. They're not going to answer the door because half the things won't be for them. They're not in a right. house in the suburbs like you are. Right. And they don't have a family member at home all day to answer the door for them.
I was so just kind of surprised that this technology exists, says Mr. Cisco, 28 years old. It's been awesome. It doesn't log out and it doesn't skip.
But you have to stand up and hold the antenna and put your left leg up.
We got to teach them that. Apparently, antenna sales are up 7%, 8 million units, according to the Consumer Technology Association. So maybe there is a boom in antenna TV. Cisco says,
I remember this back, you know, 15 years ago, we were down to 12% of America got their TV from over the air.
Right.
It's got to be next to nothing now.
Right. Almost a third of Americans, 29%, are unaware that local TV is available free, according to a survey by the National Association of Broadcasters. What? Have things changed this much? People, yep. Oh, you can watch. Wait a minute, what? It's flying through the air. Somebody says, is that legal? 24-year-old Hunter Wills, living in Chicago, mostly watches Netflix. I had no idea. I'm still not even familiar with the concept. She thought it was some modern satellite service or something. He's one of the guys says of his daughter in her early 20s. Wow.
Are we all doomed?
Yeah, we're doomed. I just want to give them a dial telephone and see what they do with it. Let's see. 2 billion users, Facebook's profits, revenues soar. Nothing more to say on that. Jeez Louise. Man. Twitter stock plunges as it shows literally zero growth in monthly active users. But Twitter said, daily active users were up 50%. 50% of what? They wouldn't say. So the SEC says, well, why don't you disclose daily user numbers? What are you hiding? 328 million monthly active users. But this letter from the SEC goes back to May. Twitter's response, it said, well, showing growth is more important than showing the number. The reason, they said, is, well, we're afraid you'll compare it to Facebook. And, quote, investors would not be able to compare for performance between the company and this other company. Too late. Of course, Facebook has 2 billion monthly active users. I don't know. I'm not worried about Twitter. They've got the Trump effect. My God, this is, Donald Trump is now issuing executive orders on Twitter.
Yeah.
Neglecting to mention it to anybody else, just putting it on Twitter. And then, oh, I loved the tweet. I don't want to knock him. But, he's the president of the United States. I acknowledge that. He's Matt's boss. But I don't want to knock him. But I have to read this tweet to you because I just was like, my jaw dropped. It wasn't the first time. He's talking about, he says, only the fake news media. Oh, crud. Let me get rid of this. Only the fake news media. And my enemies want me to stop using social media. And then I'm not sure what 110 million people, I guess, is referring to his followers. Only way for me to get the truth out. Donald, you're the president of the United States. You have a button you can press that would send a text message to every smartphone in the country. You can go
on
ABC. Don't tell him that. You can go on ABC, CBS, and NBC anytime you want and tell people anything you want. You don't need the Twitter. But please continue to use it.
And by the way, I get mad when journalists say, well, he really should get off Twitter. That is not the journalist's job to do. I say let him be him.
Yeah.
He's
the president. He can use
Twitter.
It's
not our job to tell him what to do and what not to do. No, he should tweet.
I maybe think you could argue, and I'm sure a few people in the Joint Chiefs of Staff have, that it might be better not to set military policy on Twitter. But that's just a procedural issue. I'm sorry, Matt. I shouldn't do that to you. I'm not gonna. No, don't just shut up. You didn't hear it. You didn't see it.
This
nothing
is just
happened.
Like Matt on Google topics in the old days. We always do it once a show.
Well, it's a step up. You used to not be able to talk about Google. Now you can't talk about the federal government. You're broadening your reach here. What else? Anything else we need to talk about here? Amazon.
I wanted to mention.
Go ahead.
I want to mention the somebody just threw it in the chat as well, but the UK Home Secretary Amber Rudd is in Silicon Valley.
Hanging. She's hanging.
She's trying to persuade them to not use encryption quite so much, or at least give her metadata or something. So there's this sort of long-running thing in the UK where Theresa May, who is now the Prime Minister and the previous Home Secretary, and Amber Rudd, who is the new Home Secretary, have been saying, oh, this encryption stuff's very bad, you know, we want to stop that. And everyone's been saying, you can't actually stop that, that's how things work. And so the position has moved a bit now, and they're no longer saying they want to ban encryption. They want to come to an understanding with the Silicon Valley companies to give them more metadata behind closed doors and so on. And there's a little dance going on here. So Sheryl Sandberg was on Desert Island Discs 2 days ago. Desert Island Discs is
wonderful,
one of the longest
BBC
running
program.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah. It's basically they get people to come on and they say, if we stuck you on a desert island, what would be the 8 records you would bring with you?
And play them for us.
And play them for them. And it's an excuse to talk about their lives and so on. But the Sandberg one was weird because like there's 5 minutes of her talking about encryption at the beginning of it, which I extracted and put on my website. But then she talks about her book and her husband dying, and it's actually it's a very moving show, and it's worth listening to. But it was just suddenly weird, like, oh yes, I met Amber Rudd and we're working together and all this stuff going on as well. So there's a certain amount of sort of weird stuff going on there. I think part of this is Rachel Whetstone just moved to that group at Facebook, and so she's sort of trying to smooth over the dispute between the UK government and Facebook about encryption. And you know, she's got form there because her husband used to be an advisor to the UK to the Tory party in the UK government, so on. So there's a bit of that going on as well. But there is also this thing of the position has shifted from no, we're going to hang on to encryption at all counts to I'm sure we can work something out with you. Let's go behind closed doors and talk about metadata. And then the thing that connected to for me is that there was a somebody pointed out, and I've got to try and find the link now, that if you type a URL in WhatsApp, it fetches it character by character as you type it from the server.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which is a bit weird.
Instead of holding it all, letting you type it, buffering it, and sending the URL.
Yes. And so I think it's basically trying to decide when if there's a preview for it or something like that.
Right.
But if you sit there,
it's still encrypted going to the server, right?
So the chat is encrypted between you. Between the two people you're talking
to, not to the server.
But it is fetching the URL you are typing from the server you are typing it from. So if I say there's something suspicious about this URL, let me WhatsApp it to you because I think that's secure. Actually, that URL will get a ping from WhatsApp, and it will get every character I type as well, which is kind of So that's the kind of sort of weird metadata breach that they may be talking about because that stuff is being fetched outside. So if you're sending links to people through WhatsApp, they could be leaking that because that stuff is already going out over the net. And they can track that on their exit node, presumably.
Well, we'll watch with interest the Snoopers Charter. And, of course, it's happening in Australia. I'm sure it'll happen here at some point where the governments say you must not encrypt, or we must have a backdoor into the encryption, or if we ask you, you've got to provide us with clear text of whatever those messages were. It's interesting that maybe they're willing to settle for metadata. That doesn't sound right.
Well, that's the conversation they're having.
Yeah. Well, they've got metadata mostly anyway.
Sure. But Sandberg was explicitly saying it on the clip. We can't tell what you're saying to each other, but we can tell who you were talking to.
Right.
And we could give that to the government. Right. She said that.
Good to know. That's good.
Yeah. In between choosing a song from Beyonce and a one from YouTube.
I want to know what you thought about this, Jeff Jarvis. This is from FAIR. FAIR is the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting website. Challenging media bias watchdog. Since 1986. And I like FAIR, but they say Jeff Bezos is getting a free pass, not just from his own paper, The Washington Post, but a kind of collegial free pass from the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal as well. They reviewed 190 articles over the past year. None of the articles were exposés. 6% leaned negative, 54% were straight or neutral, 40% were positive, mostly with a fawning or even press release-like tone. I do remember, though, 2 years ago, the New York Times, frankly, hit piece on Amazon's labor.
Yeah, they did.
People are crying at their desks. But there hasn't been anything. I guess since then there hasn't been anything. What do you think?
Proving a negative. I mean, it's a conservative media watchdog, and now since he owns the Washington Post, that ties that together.
It's reasonable to worry about it, I think.
But the man built a company single-handedly to make him the richest man in the world. Let's go after him. Let's not say anything nice about him. I mean,
I will be watching though to see
what
kind of coverage
they want.
I want to see more coverage of the antitrust issues Amazon's acquisition of Whole Foods, for instance, represents, and the larger issue of Amazon basically taking over all e-commerce.
Yeah, well, here's the impact on labor is huge. Here's what's going to happen. Eric Schmidt said years ago, the internet is a terribly disruptive force. Google is the biggest thing on the internet, so they're going to come after us first. Who are they going after next? Facebook is the next biggest thing in the ad duopoly. Who are they going to go after next? They're going to go after Amazon. And Amazon, for example, is just going into Australia. It's going into other countries, and it's going to have a disruptive impact there. And so, yeah, it's going to be the target of attacks. But that's also, to me, the generic tech is bad. American tech companies are bad. Let's go after them.
Right.
Bang. Tell me what Jeff Bezos is doing wrong they should be covering.
Well,
and maybe I'll listen to your story. But just saying that they're not finding horrible things about him, well,
right.
Okay.
I don't even want to get into the Bitcoin fork unless one of you can explain it to me.
I can recommend some reading.
There's a lot, there's a lot of places you go to find out more about blockchain. The fork happened on August 1st, which is yesterday. And some of the Bitcoin miners apparently were very slow to take it up the new Bitcoin Cash. You know, you have to have miners creating the Bitcoins. Miners were the ones who didn't really want Bitcoin to change, I think. At least that was my understanding of the politics involved. There's a lot of politics involved. Nevertheless, Bitcoin was getting very unwieldy. The blockchain was huge. It was really slowing down transactions. There was a strong movement to change the technology, which was rejected by the Bitcoin Foundation. So there was a split. The new Bitcoin Cash is apparently somehow compatible, but there wasn't apparently an issue with mining, because the first Bitcoin wasn't mined for a while, not until 2:20 yesterday afternoon. There might be some technical issues slowing it down, said somebody, but I think it's more the miners not jumping on this new Bitcoin Cash. So we'll watch with interest. It's one of these things. It's just so complicated. Not the technology, but just the politics of it.
But that's the thing.
It was
designed without really having governance rules, on the assumption you could replace that with code. And of course, then it's like, well, who decides who's running the code? Who decides what code is written? Who decides what code is run? So we have this sort of tension between the different groups who are writing code and then the mining syndicates who are deciding what code they run.
Yeah, the people writing the code want the blocks to be smaller and more secure. The miners would like the blocks to be much bigger. They say that makes Bitcoin faster and more scalable.
But there's also other factions within the miners, because part of it is they don't want to change.
We're just talking about the miners are in revolt.
Aren't they mostly
Chinese now? Is it almost?
Yes, yeah. They are. They are almost all Chinese, because basically you need access to free power to compete with mining.
Right.
And so they are set up in bits of China where they're plugged into hydroelectric power stations. So that blue roof building is the mining thing next to the hydroelectric dam there. So they're basically siphoning off electricity and turning it into pseudo money, and the amount of power they're using is quite remarkably high at the moment. So that's it.
Is the Chinese government then involved in Bitcoin mining?
Not officially, but yes. Obviously, if you are able to set up a thing like this and plug it into the power station, then some bits of the Chinese government are nodding somewhere.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
It sort of feels like Bitcoin is like fantasy football for geeks, though. Like
but there's real money involved.
Well, there isn't fantasy football.
Yeah.
But it feels like it finds all the friendliness of an open source community, with all the, you know, fiscal responsibility of, you know, players on Wall Street. And you put those two together, and I don't know.
It's just wild. We'll watch. We'll watch with interest. Amazon, speaking of China, Amazon has halted sales of a phone made in China, a very affordable Android device by Blue. Actually, it's a number of phones. Blue also made Windows phones. But Amazon has suspended sales of Blue phones on its site amid concerns that the device data may be being forwarded to China. A potential security issue. In November, a security firm mentioned these firmware over-the-air update software from a Chinese vendor, which was being applied to Blue phones and was then transmitting text messages and other private data to an unknown server in China. Blue announced it had requested the company to disable that functionality. The company that had made the firmware update said that they had fixed the issue, but at Black Hat, CryptoWire, the security company that discovered it, was back saying, yep, they're still transmitting users' private data, and there's a command and control server capable of installing apps, taking screenshots, recording the screen, making calls, and wiping devices without the owner's permission. Oh, so maybe if you have one of them there Blue phones, you might want to consider getting a new one. They're very affordable, $60. The particular one that CryptoWire found with the software on it was Blue R1 HD. It's Android. It's old Android. It's not very recent Android. Apparently, some Blue models are still available on Amazon. It's unclear whether Blue is culpable here or maybe one of their suppliers. And Blue phones, by the way, were on that list of phones you could get with the Amazon ads in the front that reduced the cost even further. Blue said it's going to start using Google's over-the-air update service going forward, but it argued that using the old software was not an issue. It was merely collecting information that's standard for over-the-air update functionality and consistent with other smartphone brands. I don't know if that's true. I don't know. Maybe Blue is culpable.
I'm a little skeptical. Color me skeptical, Blue.
I don't know about that. Yeah.
Yes.
Color me blue. All right. I think we can. I mean, there's so much more I could talk about. You know, net neutrality, Katie Couric leaving Oath. Tom Wheeler. Actually, let me point you to this article. I mentioned it on another show, but Tom Wheeler, in an interview with Fast Company, the former chairman of the FCC, really knocking the current chairman, Ajit Pai, saying ultimately he's doing the bidding of the four big ISPs. The money quotes pretty much at the very end. Tom Wheeler says, it looks like the FCC is standing up for four companies when you really get right down to it. There are four companies who are really the major beneficiaries of rolling back Title II regulation, net neutrality regulations. Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, and Charter. They provide the vast majority of high-speed internet in the country. Four companies. There are 1,000 companies who are the early-stage innovators, the kind of folks who bring opportunity and create new jobs, who have written letters to the FCC saying they're... And I, by the way, wrote a letter to the FCC saying exactly this. My business will be threatened by the elimination of Title II in order to increase the power of the Big Four. That is just an absolutely startling comparison. Four companies are going to get bigger and more powerful at the expense of 1,000 startups and tens of millions of consumers. That is so out of whack as to be shameful, the former commissioner of the FCC on net neutrality. I thought that was a good statement. And, you know, we thought Tom Wheeler was a dingo, but he's not.
Yeah, no, he was with the Angels.
He was with the Angels and still is. You know, he could shut up, but he's still weighing in on this one.
Yeah.
And actually, it'll be very interesting to watch. The information points out that with the AT&T Time Warner acquisition moving forward, Time Warner owns HBO. And it might be interesting to see if AT&T, which has a significant amount of debt, might start to cut back the amount of money HBO gets for original programming. That could be a little inside fight. Did you see... I think, Jeff, you posted this. This is the funniest thing ever.
This is funny. Yeah.
From the ACLU, they filed an amicus brief. John Oliver, on his show, said something bad about what is the guy, own coal mines? He's a coal magnate.
Coal mines, I think, yeah.
It's a coal magnate, as they say. Robert E. Bob Murray. Murray didn't like it that John Oliver said bad things about him, so he sued HBO and John Oliver. And the ACLU has filed, I think, probably the best legal document I've ever read on behalf of the defendant, John Oliver, and HBO.
Just the table of contents is hilarious.
Oh, yeah, because, I can't. Basically, one of the lines in the show was, eat poop, Bob, only in a little more strongly. And the ACLU points out, anyone can legally say, eat poop, Bob.
And the comment on the rundown is my favorite excerpt.
Okay, let me find that here. Hold on a second. The comment on the rundown, all I have is a Scribd article. Where does the comment?
I added a comment. Hover over the
hover. I don't understand hover. Okay, here it is. This case is beyond meritless. This is the ACLU writing. It is offensive to the very ideals of free speech embodied in the First Amendment. The fact that the plaintiffs filed this case, by the way, Bob is apparently known to be fairly litigious. The fact the plaintiffs filed this case is ridiculous enough, but to pour gasoline on the fire, plaintiffs' counsel has also filed a motion asking the court to make John Oliver not say mean things about him anymore. It is frankly shocking the plaintiffs were able to find attorneys willing to file a lawsuit that is so obviously unconstitutional. It is apt that one of the plaintiffs' objections to the show is about a human-sized squirrel named Mr. Nutterbutter, because this case is nuts! Which also begs the question, is Mr. Nutterbutter one of the 50 Doe defendants included in this action? I love it. Somebody at the ACLU had a lot of fun writing that brief.
Ball.
Isn't that awesome? And I don't think Bob's point was to win in this case, but just to harass John Oliver. And he got attention for it. All right. Let's wrap this thing up. Matt, you've been so great. It's been so nice to have you. I'm going
to guess your
thing, your pick of the week might have something to do with the U.S. Digital Service.
It does. I'll just tell you about one industry practice we brought in, which is called a bug bounty. If you listen to This Week in Google or any of Leo's shows, you're familiar with the idea of paying for a security hole so that other bad people don't exploit that security hole. But the federal government had never done a bug bounty before. So they ran one last year. It was called Hack the Pentagon. It turns out they were able to find a lot of great security holes. They lowered the cost of finding those security holes and better protected federal websites and technology.
It cost $150,000. It would have cost more than a million.
Yeah, chicken feed by government terms, basically.
Yeah,
they've
That's
done
one screwdriver.
Hack the Army.
Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. they're better at this.
But I'm teasing. I tease.
They just finished running Hack the Air Force, so they've done several of these, including a classified one. So if you are the sort of person who has heard of a bug bounty or has deployed things to the cloud, and you think you might be able to do a few months tour in D.C., I encourage you to check out usds.gov. Nice. We have that /join page.
I suspect.
How do you do a classified bug bounty?
Oh, you get researchers who have been pre-qualified, and you make sure that they're in a cyber range. That's what they call it. They do it on a cyber range.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and they found good security holes in that one, too. Like, bug bounties are a great way to find security holes. And now they have a vulnerability disclosure policy. There's going to be civilian bug bounty programs in the next few months. So this is like you're coming from the future if you're coming from the tech industry, and you can bring these time-tested, battle-tested techniques that everybody knows works that aren't really that risky and make government work better.
As ever, our friend, you're doing God's work.
And I imagine there are quite a few hackers now, white hat hackers now, who make a living on bug bounties. There's a significant amount of money.
So for Hack the Air Force, I think there was like a 17-year-old that made something like $39,000. And it's still a good deal for everybody by finding the security holes.
Yeah.
So
really nice work. And some of these bug bounties are, Microsoft just announced bug bounties in over $100,000 for one edge flaw or whatever it was. No, it was a Hyper-V flaw. So there's some big money in this. Well, good. That's pretty cool. We never, it's probably not in your realm, but someday would like to pick your brain on the vulnerabilities equity process and where that stands now in the government. Mm-hmm. This was the idea that there should be a process. Once an intelligence agency like the NSA or the CIA discovers a flaw, an exploit, there should be a process in which it justifies holding on to it, or the decision is made whether to reveal it to the company so they can fix the flaw. And this was created in the Obama administration a few years ago. And do they do it still, or is it just kind of fallen by the wayside? Or
there's a lot of nuance to that, so that's a long topic of discussion.
Yeah.
But I will say, everybody agrees that government IT systems should be secure, and bug bounties are a really cool tool that industry found years and years ago. Yep. So it's a good idea across the board.
Yep. I agree. Nice dodge. Well done. Bravo.
At least I don't have to talk about the algorithm.
We love you, Matt. Oh, I'll tell you, you're great. Hey, how about a number of the week, Jeff Jarvis?
So I was a little appalled when this story came by, and I thought it was a good one for today. There's a restaurant in Silicon Valley, $600 a head Silicon Valley restaurant with gold-flecked steaks.
Oh, please.
Now, you see these kinds of ridiculous stories. You can find
it does not look like a good steak.
No, it looks awful.
That looks like a minute steak with gold leaf on it.
And, you know, if I
I'll
were,
make you
I
come to my house, give me $500,
companies.
I'll make you a nice ribeye, 2.5 inches thick. It'll be delicious and no gold flake.
I'll eat it at Elgin's first.
Elgin's is even
but
better.
If I were a PR at any of the technology companies, I would want to send out a quiet classified memo that says, don't go there.
Yeah.
You're going to make Silicon Valley just look awful. I think there's a backlash against technology and technologists. I think they're the new 1%. I'm worried about the reaction to Silicon Valley as a whole. And this kind of place does not help.
This is they only have 3 to 5 dinners a week. It's a Japanese chef, Hiroshi Kimura, who moved to Silicon Valley and launched this Deep Pockets, you know, concept restaurant. Dinners $3.95 a head, $500 to $600 with beverages and taxes. I got to point out that there are, I mean, if you go to French Laundry in Yountville up our way, it's going to cost you that much as well.
That much?
Oh, yeah.
That much?
Oh, yeah.
With wine.
Oh, yeah.
Well, without the wine, is it $300 a head?
I could take you to several restaurants in Napa that would cost you that much. Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah, I'm just a Chipotle guy.
Yeah, you spend too much time at Chipotle.
But you never do, Leo. I don't know why.
I'll tell you why. But strange is it's in a shopping plaza in Los Altos. So it's not really, I mean, look, there's a shoe rack outside. It's not really, it's not the, but there you go, you know, there you go.
Yeah.
Hiroshi's open by appointment only. It's kind of, you know what? Go to Morimoto. Okay, obviously this is A5 Wagyu. That's why it's so expensive. But go to Morimoto. You can get a nice Wagyu for less than that. Well, that looks good. I'll take that. That looks like that's the tonkatsu sandwich, breaded deep-fried pork cutlet in demi-glace. You get 10 courses. Come on, Jeff. What's the problem?
Image.
Oh, there you go. That is beautiful. That is.
Jeff, you're in New York. You have this nonsense.
Yeah, please, Jeff.
I'm worried about Silicon Valley.
I think you're an impecunious professor. You just don't understand. I've had food in Paris with gold leaf on it. We went to Loic Lemaire took us to Guy Savoie, and some of the food had gold leaf on it. I don't know why, because it doesn't add anything to the flavor.
Yeah,
I tell you,
right.
It's probably not very good for you, Mr. Marks.
No,
I bet you want
to bowel.
Yeah, there's no real. It's without like some good roughage, I guess. But what do you got for us, Jeff? I'm sorry, Kevin.
I've got three things up. My usual thing is indieweb.org, homebrew website club. There was going to be one this week in Portland, but it was so hot they moved it to next week as well. So they're all happening next week.
What is hot in Portland? Like 82 degrees?
112.
Oh! Portland can't take that.
They're not ready for it. You know,
snowflakes
are going to
melt. That's terrible. Wow.
But it gets muggy there. And, you know, 112 where you are is like you can live with it, because whereas in Portland, when it's that hot, it's also sweaty and it's bad. I was there when it was hitting like 95 and it was much less comfortable than Silicon Valley. Homebrew Website Club is happening London, Brighton, Portland, San Francisco, and a few other places in Germany that I've forgotten. So good to that. The Liberty Foundation I wanted to mention. This is another Portland connection here. This is a great idea by Andy McMillan, who's one of the organizers of XOXO. He's trying to set up a way to support artists to maintain momentum and work through that. So this is well worth paying attention to and helping him fund this. It's a great idea. And then the third one I've got is completely crazy, but I think you'll like it, Jeff. So have a look at this thing. There's a video on the Twiddly.
If you have one extra thumb, just think of what you could do.
Of all you could do.
Yeah. It's on the other side from your regular thumb. So you have two opposable thumbs. This New Zealand designer, Danny Claude, developed his 3D printed. It's a prosthetic. I don't know how do you control it, Kevin?
It's attached to your legs. So you have to be sitting down, but then you flex your legs and that controls the thumb.
Uh-huh. Huh. Uh-huh. Just a new way to play gin rummy, apparently. Hold those extra big hands.
Or to hit those extra guitar notes you couldn't hit otherwise.
You can thumb
almost a parody video.
Wow. Wow, I feel like the whole show came from The Onion today. I swear to God.
Yeah, since it's in your show, it's
a Kickstarter.
That's wild. That's wild.
I just thought you'd like that, Leo. That's sure. Very Leo.
Sure. I need it. I got to buy it. I'm ordering it now.
If it were on Kickstarter, he'd buy it already.
Oh, yeah. I would have already bought it. That's exactly right. I'm still waiting for Stacy told me about those LED light up eyelashes, and I ordered those. So that should be fun.
Cool.
Matt, so nice to see you. Congratulations on your good works, and thank you for sacrificing on all of our behalf. It's great.
It's really so good to be back on this week in Google, and it's hilarious because I was reading the chat, and somebody was like, okay, where's the application page? So that warms my heart.
USDS.gov/join. USDS.gov/join. And absolutely. What a contribution. Thank you, Kevin Marks. It's midnight.
It's just started raining here.
And it's pouring in the UK. Well, of course. Well, once it never rained till after sundown. So Kevin is at indieweb.org and doing a great job. And love to your poodles. And we will see you again very soon. I hope you'll come back and join us.
Yeah, I'll look forward to it.
That's rain?
Well, I'm in the conservatory, so it's raining on the roof.
Ah, of course. Are you in the conservatory with Professor Plum and the lead pipe? Thank you, Kevin.
When they're conservatory with the poodles, so that's where they hang out.
Thank you, too. And thanks to MIT for allowing Jeff to spend some time
MIT and the Media Lab.
Magic room in the Media Lab. Jeff Jarvis is at buzzmachine.com and joins us each week here every Wednesday, about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. For this week in Google. Thanks to all of you for being here. You can watch live at twit.tv/live. You can join us in the studio as Brandon, Jeff, and Melinda have. All you have to do is email tickets at twit.tv. Or, by the way, if you are live, chat with us at irc.twit.tv. It's always nice to have the chat room behind the scenes throwing spitballs or bouquets. But if you can't be here live, you can always get the show on demand audio and video of everything we do. Is available both at our website, twit.tv, in this case, twit.tv/twig, and wherever you get your podcasts. I mean, we are on every app, every platform. In fact, do me a favor, subscribe to Twig. That way you'll get it every single week. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.